Guess we're good. We're good to embark on the much ballyhooed Austin Goolsbee part of the program. I first became aware of Austin Goolsbee through his writings at Slate. Austin is a professor of economics at the University of Chicago, and his writings in Slate on whole range of subjects about the way integrating economics and analysis into the way we look at things made me have a serious case of editor's envy. And Austin, of course, was one of the foundational thinkers of Obamanomics and was a very early advisor to the campaign, and now plays a very central role in shaping policy in the White House from his perch, where he's on the Council of Economic Advisors and also the director of the President's Economic Recovery Board. And Austin, I think, is going to talk for 10, 15 minutes, and then he'll open up the floor to your questions. So thank you so much for coming here.
Thanks, Frank. I appreciate it. Yeah, that slight, that was before I had ever thought anything about it. And then when they were vetting me, I remember the guy said, "What were you thinking? Why did you write all this stuff down?" I was like, "Oh, I didn't know that I was going to be doing this." So I thought what I'd do today is just talk for a few minutes, lay out, talk a little bit about what the president talked about in New York today, a little bit about the stimulus, maybe a half point about healthcare, and then I just wanted to open it up and have a little dialogue because I think it might be fairly interesting given the quality of the audience. The first thing that I guess I would start with is the president's speech, that it's the one-year anniversary of Lehman. Jesus, I say that was a dog year if ever there was a dog year. And we've gone through an unbelievable up and down. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that perhaps most economists believe that by the last quarter of 2008 and the beginning of 2009, we really were sort of this close to facing another Great Depression. The Great Depression was essentially very stiff recession coupled with big financial crisis, added to a series of policy missteps that became an epic downturn that essentially won't solve itself. So a lot of business cycles had the feature that they go down and they kind of reach this point of return. And the Great Depression was different because you reached a point of no return where the financial system begins imploding. And once that happens, you kind of can't get out of it. By 2008, going into 2009, we had the stiffest recession since 1929. We had a financial crisis every bit as scary as the one at the beginning of 1929. And were it with some missteps in policy, or were it not for the creative application of actions at the Fed and in this administration, I think we really could have been looking at that same sort of continuing domino implosion of the financial system, and it would have been an awful, awful circumstance. Now, the first thing that everybody thinks once you get past that, once it's, are we safe? Once you're safe, then the question is, how did this happen? And one major component of how it happened was a lack of robust regulatory oversight of the financial system. That's not to say that the government was at fault. Clearly, they didn't do it, but the lack of oversight and letting things fall through the cracks contributed to taking what felt like it began as a subprime or housing bubble-driven financial crisis that quickly infected the rest of the economy in a rapid and major way. The fear, I think, that a lot of people have, and certainly I'm one of those, about the issue of financial regulatory reform, and why I think it's so important that the president is out pushing that as a priority, is that because we didn't have a depression, because the world basically survived, that brief moment where even your mother seemed to be interested in whether credit default swaps were to be traded on exchanges or over the counter has basically gone away. My mom is back to, yeah, whatever. And once you get to that circumstance, there is a great fear that now financial regulatory reform is just going to be one of those things that's stuck in the whatever banking committee, and they're going to work to some compromise and pass some bill. And that is, the special interest will once again dominate that process, that we won't have thought through how to protect against, protect consumers or protect investors or prevent the worst kinds of products from posing a threat to the whole system. So I think it's really quite important that we confront that. It's not that sexy of an issue. It's not that fun to deal with, the financial crisis. As I say, that dealing with cleaning up a gigantic financial crisis and preventing it from getting worse was never really on the presidential bucket list of what would I like to do when I grow up. I'd like to make sure that the banking system doesn't fail and inject, you know, a capital assistance program to prevent them from going under. But the fact that it wasn't what anybody wanted to do, I think the president deserves great credit for still stepping forward, and Chairman Bernanke deserves great credit of stepping forward and saying, look, we've got to deal with this because the alternative is so awful that that even if it entails doing some of the things that are not politically especially palatable, it's really important that we do so. Now, one of those things that, if it doesn't deserve pride of place, is at least a major, major assist, in my view, in getting us away from the precipice, was the stimulus package, which was the second thing I wanted to talk about. There has now been a little counter-narrative, largely coming from Republicans, that say stimulus is no good. We ought to cancel the rest of the stimulus. Partly things are starting to look better, so it's unneeded, and partly saying, no, it doesn't do anything. Stimulus is irrelevant. As I said this morning, I view this a bit as the congressional version of the East German judge, where it doesn't matter how successful the stimulus is, and it doesn't matter if the president himself could do a triple backflip, they're still going to give it a 2. One feels that they had the talking points written out before they even saw what was in the stimulus. The CEA last week released a detailed report using all the evidence we have thus far about what has been the impact of the stimulus. And despite the pleas of the economists, it's too early, we don't have enough data, you know, give us more. We were not given that luxury. We took everything that we were able to get to try to analyze it. And I think the direct evidence is pretty strong, and I invite everybody to go read it. I think the evidence is pretty strong that the recovery package had a pretty significant impact on changing the trajectory of what the economy was going to do. Now, separate from the direct effect, I think if you talk to anybody in the marketplace, they also say the passage of the stimulus had a major, you could call it a psychological or an impact on expectations. But when they're sitting facing the Great Depression in the face, if the answer was, what are we going to do? And the answer that came to the question, what are we going to do? The answer came back, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to kind of let it fix itself. That would have been awful. And the knowledge that there was $800 billion coming in that was going to, in some sense, set a floor on how bad things could get, or would at least be pushing the other way when the conditions deteriorated, had an important impact on markets, even separate from the direct impact of the stimulus itself. That said, the stimulus itself, number one, a lot of the money has gone out. The critique that, no, the stimulus, they haven't even spent anything, is completely false. Of the $787 billion, $150 billion has either been directly spent or gone out through the making work pay tax cut, which went to 95% of workers. They adjusted the withholding, so the money went out, even though it wasn't a direct spending. $150 billion, so 15 to 20% of the money, got out the door. and another $140 billion has been obligated. And so just a brief detour. If you see people saying, the infrastructure, hardly any of the money has gone out. Remember, an infrastructure project, the money doesn't go out until the project is completed and somebody walks down there and checks it and says, yes, there's not a big hole in this bridge. This is okay. You get your money. That's not the correct measure. What's the correct measure for many of these projects is when is the money obligated, which means the government signs a contract that says we are obligated to pay you if you deliver on this project according to these specifications. It is the obligation which leads them to go out and start the project because they know we're going to do it, we're going to get the payment. So with direct money that's out plus obligations, more than a third of the stimulus money is already into the system, which is a very healthy, sizable amount. In addition, spacing it out over the 18-month to 2.5-year time frame is what you wanted to do. If you could have taken $787 billion and dumped it all into the economy in a 2-week period in February, you wouldn't have wanted to do it that way. When you look at the threats facing the economy in 2010 and 2011, namely a massive uncertainty about commercial real estate, what impact that will have on industry, on the real estate sector, and on the regional and smaller banks, you got to at least have some concerns that that could be a further drag on the macro economy. When you look at the state fiscal positions, where almost all states have a balanced budget requirement, so as the economy gets worse, they have to raise taxes and cut spending, which is a further aggregate drag on the economy. Both of those problems have a decent likelihood to get worse in 2010 and 2011. And so the thought that there is still a significant amount of money in the pipeline to fight against those things over the next 18 months, I think is exactly what we want to have happen. I think we would not be feeling too good if we had just dumped the entire thing and now there wasn't anything left to come. So I think for those people saying we should now cancel the stimulus and forget the next 2/3 of the money, I kind of think we're in loony land. I mean, that is the opposite of what we should do. Christy Romer, who is very sorry not to have been able to be here today, is an expert on the Depression. She's an academic economic historian. And she cites the example of 1937 as a cautionary tale for all of us that in the actual Depression, things get bad, they start to improve, it looks like they're on a good trajectory. And so in 1937, they say, okay, look, everything's getting better. Let's cancel the stimulus. Let's raise taxes. Let's cut spending and balance the budget. And it drives the economy back into a serious double dip recession that really only World War II pulls us out of. So we certainly should not be talking about exit strategy and tightening the belt until it's clear we're out of the woods on this. And I don't think we're there yet. I will not bore you with the details. I refer you to the report. We've got all kinds of evidence looking at internationally. If you look at countries where they had bigger stimulus, they had better growth across states, across different municipalities. It looks like the stimulus had some impact. And I think it's rather important that we acknowledge the role that government policy played in getting us away from that. Why don't I hold off on healthcare? And if people want to ask about that, I have some thoughts. But why don't we just open it up to some questions? I see they've got the microphone, so just raise it. If nobody has a question, I'm a professor. I can filibuster all day if need be. But if you do have a question, just take the make sure to take the microphone.
So the question is, when you guys think internally about not the next year, but the next sort of 2, 3, 4 years, and think about where growth comes from once we're kind of firmly back away from the precipice, which it looks like we're moving toward, where do you look? Like if you just do the kind of basic GDP identity that they teach you in Macro 101, you know, you've got consumer spending, which doesn't look like it's promising for a while. You've got net exports, which with the rest of the world also sort of still very weak. In a lot of the major industrial economies doesn't look super promising. Government spending you talked about, but that can't go on forever. And then you have investment, which, you know, who knows? I mean, which one of those four looks like it's going to generate growth?
Okay, the first thing, this is a good question. It also relates to a fallacy that you'll sometimes hear. So you'll see people look around and say, well, the savings rate was less than zero at several points in the 2000s and basically averaged about 0%. And the savings rate is now going up. Therefore, there's not going to be any consumption growth. And housing construction is completely moribund. And so what are we going to do? If you go back to the mid-2000s, it was a recovery that was led by residential housing investment and personal consumption. It would be relatively difficult to envision going back to the world, you know, and so they'll say, what are we going to do? We can't go back to either of those. The only thing I would caution everybody is the mid-2000s was not necessarily the normal boom, and it's not necessarily the most desirable boom. To have a consumption-driven and housing investment-driven boom is almost certainly not what we want to do right now. I think partly this depends on how rapidly the economy comes back, but I think the long-run growth, if you go back to earlier periods, it was more business investment-driven. It was more and could be more net export-driven. A lot of people say that we've had these massive imbalances, trade imbalances and others, that will eventually start to equalize. And if they do, manufacturing, as an example, in the U.S. could come booming back and based on exports. And in the medium term, if income growth restarts, you can, in some sense, have both more savings and more consumption. So consumption growth in the aggregate could go up even if, as a share of income, people are saving more money. It just, you got to be making more money for that to happen. So I guess the answer that I have mentally been thinking is business investment, net exports, and to a lesser extent, consumption would be where you might tend to see it. And partly it depends on how rapidly things come back, where you've got two things playing off against each other. One is deeper recessions tend to, when they recover, have stronger recoveries. But credit crunch recessions tend to have slower recoveries. So everybody, I try to stay out of the forecasting business because I'm not especially good at it. But I've talked to a lot of the private forecasters, and I would characterize they're trying to weigh off those two things. It's not clear which one of those will balance off. I think the job market is likely to remain in a tough spot for the entirety of the short term because jobs tend to respond with a lag. You got to turn the economy and the GDP around before you can start creating jobs. And there tends to be kind of the waterfall hierarchy that first GDP turns around, then you'll see hours go up for people who have jobs, followed by temporary employment, followed by payroll employment, followed behind all of those things by the unemployment rate coming down. Because each of those, you know, you'll start getting a bunch of guys coming out of from the state out of the labor force into the labor force, which tends to drive up the unemployment rate. So most experts that I've talked to forecast the unemployment rate peaking above 10%. And really not doing that till, you know, the end of this year or even beginning of next year.
According to the forecasts from the OMB and the CBO, we're looking at a cumulative federal deficit of the order of $9 trillion over a 10-year time frame. Could you comment on whether the administration has any plans to address that in some way or another? And secondly,
sure.
What proportion of that cumulative deficit does the administration think the People's Republic of China will obligingly finance?
Look, let's start with the one can tell the attempt at something inflammatory in both of those. But on the first, let's start with some of the basic facts about the 10-year deficit. It is true it's $9 trillion and it's up multiple trillions. If you asked the people who do not wait with bated breath to get the blue book from OMB each year, who may know the details, if you just ask the average person, how is it that the 10-year deficit went up by several trillion and is now $9 trillion? They would say, well, it's because that liberal Obama is spending us out of existence. Okay, and that's totally and completely false. That's not what the data show at all. By far the predominant thing that happened to the 10-year deficit is we got in the worst recession since 1929. And when that occurs, the way budget forecasting works, when you're in a deep recession and revenues are low and spending is high because of various stabilizers, that factors into the 10-year forecast, and so it goes way up in recessions. It tends to happen the opposite way in booms, and so at the end of the 90s and in the mid-2000s, the 10-year deficit numbers start coming in way better than expected, and it's because it's reflecting the current business cycle. The second major thing that happened is the Obama administration comes in and explicitly decides to stop engaging in a series of budgetary gimmicks that have been part and parcel of the budget process for many, many years. Things like projecting there's not going to be a long, there's not going to be a 10-year deficit, that it will be smaller because we're going to cut the salaries of all doctors and reimbursements by 20% at the end of the year. Then at the end of the year, passing a rule, well, actually, we're not going to do that this year. But for accounting purposes, we're going to count on doing that next year and forevermore. We're going to cut those out. And each year, just saying, actually, we're not going to do it this year. So that increases the current year deficit, but never counts to the 10-year. Saying the R&D tax credit is temporary and just extending it every year. Putting in zero for natural disaster costs. Even though there's a hurricane season, every year hurricane season comes, there's a hurricane. Oh my goodness, we've got costs for hurricanes. Who could have predicted this? So that doesn't go in the long-term budget. Okay, so a series of things like that, the war, the natural disaster, all this stuff. Obama comes in and says, this is ridiculous. Look, the R&D tax credit, let's call it permanent because it's permanent. Let's take out all of this stuff that are budgetary gimmicks. When you do that, you haven't done anything. You're not spending any more money. All of that stuff would have happened anyway. What you've done is stop lying about it, yet there are people who say, look, you increased the deficit. Okay, now, I think that's not totally fair. All of that said, so that's kind of the short to medium term, there's an optimistic scenario, which is, hey, the economy starts to recover, stuff goes back to what it was kind of in the mid-2000s. That said, everybody knows there's a long-run fiscal challenge facing the country, which is not the what's the 10-year budget forecast for this year. The long-run fiscal challenge facing the country is overwhelmingly, number one, the healthcare cost inflation rate, and secondarily, the aging of the population. And we are going to have to deal with those issues. They very much motivated the president's initial calls and continuing interest in healthcare reform, that we've got to deal with that issue, partly as a budgetary matter to the government, but also partly for family budgets. I mean, the same dynamic that's making it super expensive to the government for Medicare is making it super expensive to, you know, the 45-year-old father of two who's trying to buy his own health care. Or mother of two buying her. You know, the costs of health care are in the long run the overwhelmingly important thing. I'm not actually that optimistic that at this moment we're going to have an adult conversation about what are our options on long-run fiscal, what are the long-run fiscal choices, when even discussing Medicare, you know, you got you guys coming down saying they want to pull the plug on grandma. This strikes me as not an opportune moment, you know, to engage in that discussion. But that issue, the long-run fiscal health of the country, has not gotten substantially different than it was 2 years ago. It's the same. The only thing that's changed is this 10-year budget has changed, and almost all of that, I think, is from the changes in the economy.